Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 6, delivered on September 6, 2018. The title of this lecture is Analysis of Financial Statements.
Today, analysis of financial statements. But as usual, before we begin, we're going to talk about the markets today, and I'm going to take you a little deeper in your thinking about markets. First things first, let's pull up the numbers and have a look at what's going on. Sir, good day, bad day on the street? What do you see?
Overall, I'd say it's a bad day.
Good. Very good. You see one green there, but that green is about as pale green as you can get. The 0.08% up on the Dow, which is nothing exciting. You had a almost 0.4% down on the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ got whacked almost a full percent. So overall, it was not a very clean day on the street. And that's just, but if we were to go in and look at the, for example, the Standard & Poor's 500 portfolio, see how that did. You notice that at the beginning there was a bullish run. It was bullish at the beginning, but then the bears just started, and there were a couple of attempts at a rally. And at the end, the market was correcting back upward, bargain hunters and all that, but it never got back to where it was at the start. So we did have a down day on the Standard & Poor's 500. Not impressive at all. However, overall, again though, trading was fairly light. On balance volume for the day was lower than the 52-week moving average. So we've got that, although it was a little bit stronger than it has been. Generally, as a rule, as I said, politics does not enter into markets unless there's something really dramatic that has economic impact. And the day-to-day politics that we're seeing now, as historically weird as it is, really hasn't gotten the markets too interested in watching what's going on. However, we need to keep an eye on that infamous yield curve, which is a predictor, can show us the possibility that a recession is coming. Now, as I said, we need to know, we get really excited if we have an inversion of the yield curve. And for the time being, though, let's have a look quickly. And again, I don't have my bookmarks here, so I have to go in. Yield curve chart. We're going to look at the spread. Come on. Go. Okay. We're looking at the 7-10-year notch. It is staying, unfortunately, at 5 basis points. Again, if the 7 goes above the 10, we have the inversion, and we would have a recession, very likely within about 6 months. It's not done it yet. However, let's go over here, and I want you to look at the dynamic yield curve. And I'm going to go a little deeper than I usually do because it's time for you to get a little bit closer to. This is the visual representation of what you just saw, today's yield curve. It is unhealthy. It is a sickly yield curve. It should have a nicer arch to it. It just doesn't have that nice arch. It's flattened out. What we're worried about, of course, is if this goes above this, that's the inversion, that's the recession coming. It's not done it yet, but it, overall, this doesn't look good in any way. Now we're going to go out here and we're going to talk. And this is where I need you to use your eyes and start to do a more critical analytical, which is what businesses want out of you. They want you to be able to look and see things. Now, this is 6 months ago. Now, let's pull ourselves back toward the present. Now, let me do that again. What do you see happen between 6 months and maybe about 2 months ago? Let me do it again. I wish I could just loop that. I probably could if I had the ambition to do it myself. Look through here, and what do you see happening to yields from about 6 months ago to 2 months ago? Well, actually, to about 3 months ago. Yes, go ahead.
6 months ago,
they were a lot bigger. The yields out here. Okay, now, what do you see? The curve is sagging. Those yields in the intermediates, those are the ones from the 2, 3, 5, 7, 10, sag. Those yields began to fall. Now, why would the yields be falling? Well, yields are inversely related to prices. Prices go up, yields go down. So we see that sag happening there in the intermediates. That would mean that the prices of those securities, those treasuries, the two, five, especially the 5, 7, and 10s, were dropping. The yields were going down, which means the prices of those were going up. Now, two reasons price can go up. Demand is going up or supply is going down, one or the other. But then the truly concerning part. Look what happens in here. What do you see coming? What do you see from 3 months to now? Look at it again. See it? What's happening to the yields on the long, the 20 and 30? You see it? Tell me. What do you see? Let me do it again. Look where the yields were. First, the intermediates sag. But then the long stuff, the 10, 20s, and 30s, look at those yields. What are they doing? Can you see it? They come up. So the long end of the yield curve is beginning to pull upward. In other words, those yields are rising, which means that those prices are falling on those bonds, on the long bonds. These are government bonds. Now, prices, in other words, we see the yields going up, which means that the prices are going down. There are two reasons that prices go down. You want to try the economics of it? Nope. You know it. Anyone want to try the economics of it? Why do prices go down? Why would prices go down?
Because demand either goes down.
Demand goes down. That will cause prices to go down because not as many people want them. Or
supply goes up.
Yahtzee. So in other words, the long end bonds that are 10, 20, and 30, either, okay, the yields are rising, so prices are falling on those long bonds. Prices would be falling either because demand is slacking off for them, or the supply of those kinds of bonds is increasing. In fact, Both are happening. First, the supply of 10, 20, and 30-year bonds is skyrocketing. Why? Because when the government borrows money, the way it does it is it sells these bonds. And when the government needs a lot of money, it sells a lot of these. Supply goes up, price goes down, yields go up. We are running the largest deficits in American history. We are spending like blind trout, and we have had another round of unnecessary tax cuts that are massive. So how does the government pay? It borrows money. So if it borrows money, that means that the way the government borrows money is it sells treasury paper. It sells treasury bonds. The buyers, by buying it, that's how they lend our government money. We need this every 2 weeks, we're going to run an auction, okay? At this auction, we have 10, 20, and 30. We need a lot of money, $50 billion. So we make $50 billion worth of these treasury bonds, 10, 20s, and 30s, and then we say, world, come and buy our bonds. Come and buy our bonds. The supply is going up very rapidly because our government has nowhere near enough money to pay for what it's doing. And that's largely right now because of these huge tax cuts that were put into place. The same thing that happened, we're running budget surpluses at the end of the 90s. But then there was these big tax cuts in early 2000s, and sure enough, we went back into the deficit territory. Okay, get in there. Go on, get. You heard me. Okay. Now, who's lending us money? Who buys these? Who buys our treasuries? Go ahead. Federal Reserve buys some of them, but it can't print money fast enough for this. China. Who else? Whoa. China. The Arabs. The Japanese. The Canadians. The God knows who. They buy the paper. In other words, they lend us money. Where did China get the money? Remember, because they can buy our paper, but they have to buy it with American dollars. Where did they get the American dollars to do this? How could a China have all of these American dollars that they lend us? They can't lend us money in euros or in any other currency. They have to lend it to us in dollars. Where did they get all of those dollars so that they can buy our treasury? Do you know where they get it? How? No, we don't. That's not how it works. Do you want to? Go ahead.
Don't they match their currency with World Bank notes?
Nope. It's a much simpler process, but almost no one knows about this process. And this is the cool thing. You are going to know here something that we've done some surveys, probably about 99.5% of the population in the United States has no clue. Go.
Trade deficits.
Yahtzee. Do you own a Keurig or do you own a Japanese car or did you buy a toaster? A microwave? Do you have a smartphone? Okay, here's what happens. You, sir, buy a toaster made in China. The toaster comes here, and the money that you bought it with goes there. It's an exact mirror reflection. When we import a toaster, we export the American dollars to buy it. It is a mirror image transaction. Everything that we import from another country is exactly matched by an export of that many American dollars to that country. You see, in the case, for example, of let's say we got this toaster. Now, when you buy that toaster, say it costs $10. Those $10, the toaster goes to your house, right?
There's a distribution center.
Let's be honest. It's not a house, it's a hovel. But we'll let it go at that.
I could call it a hovel.
It's nice.
I call it a shanty palace.
You should consider a double-wide trailer. Double-wide trailer... you know, for a... I was going to say a double-wide trailer for a double-wide spouse and all that kind of stuff. Indicator, south side.
Right.
But the thing, though, is that those $10 go to China. They do not go to the manufacturer in China. They actually go to the People's Bank of China, their central bank. And then the central bank gives the equivalent in the Chinese currency to the manufacturer. Now, what is the... What's the Chinese currency? Do you know what it is? No. It's called the yuan. Yuan. Can you say that? Say it.
Yuan.
No, yuan.
Yeah.
Yuan.
Yeah.
Yuan. Yeah. Oh, oh. No. Yuan. Otherwise known as the renminbi. Okay, so the dollars actually go to the Central Bank of China. And that builds up what is called the Foreign Reserve of China. We also have another name for those foreign reserves in Canada, in Germany, in Japan, in China. Their accumulation of American dollars in their foreign reserves are called, you've probably heard this term somewhere, euro dollars. Those are our dollars in their countries. They cannot spend those any place except in the country of origin. So if China has euros, it can't spend them anywhere but in Europe. If it has American dollars, it can't spend those anywhere but in the United States. That's how international trade works. When we import goods and services, we export American dollars. Those accumulate as foreign reserves, euro dollars, in the countries in which they occurred. So, your question. Oh, no, we don't. How would we?
Oh, right, because we owe them all.
Yeah, we take more from them than they take from us. So we get lots of nice foreign products on our shelves at cheap prices, and they get the equivalent of American dollars in their foreign reserves. Now, those are building in the People's Bank of China. China can spend them no place but in the United States. In capital investments. We call the short-term movements this way, toaster for money, the current account. The backflow, when the money comes back here, we call that the capital account. The current account is negative, dollars flowing excessively. The capital account has to be positive, those dollars coming back here as long-term investment. Okay, the capital account. There's a problem here, though. You see, the problem is this. Okay, these foreign countries have our dollars. They bring them back here and invest. They lend money to our government. They lend money to our corporations. They buy stock and stock offerings. They provide the liquidity for your student loans, for your car loans, for banks in general. Those foreign dollars, those American dollars in foreign banks, provide the liquidity and the capital to keep our country running when it can't control itself on its spending. And they've been doing it for now 17 years. We had it under control in the 1990s, and then we just blew it. And we started building these massive deficits and all these foreign reserves. But there's a problem now. China has all these American dollars that they come back here and they lend to our government. But what's going on right now that's going to disrupt that? Any? Yeah. Yahtzee. We're saying, China, we don't want no business from you anymore. Go to hell. We're America. Okay? You see, there's a problem with that. Yeah, China cheats. There's no doubt about that. China has been a cheater for years. We actually have turned a blind eye to it, partly because we had this belief that if we let China grow very rapidly its manufacturing sector, the economic freedom would lead to demands for political freedom, and that would break the back of communism in China. Didn't work. They're Chinese. They're a lot more experienced than we are. But yeah, they do cheat. But here's a problem. I want you to imagine, sir, You're in a poker game, and you've got an opponent who's cheating. Now, this opponent is 6'8", 300 pounds of solid muscle, and he's a mixed martial arts expert. Now, are you going to say, "You are cheating. Stop it"?
Probably not.
No. See my nose? Do you notice how my nose points this way? Rule one, don't try to fix your first broken nose yourself. Rule two, the next time you break your nose, do not try to fix it so that you fix what you did wrong the first time. See rule one. Okay? We are in a position where we have no leverage to be telling China what to do because they're the ones, and the Arabs and the Canadians and the Japanese and a whole lot of other people. We buy their cheap stuff and we send them our dollars so they can put them back here in capital investments. We're in no position to do what we're doing, but spank me Jesus, we're going to do it anyway. And what does that mean? The supply of our treasury debt is skyrocketing, which drives the price down, which drives the yields up. See it? Look, that's the first thing. We're running these massive budget deficits, so the yields are, the prices of bonds are, of treasury bonds are going down, so the yields are going up, and then we're telling the Chinese, go to hell. So they say, okay, no demand for your bonds, demand goes down, prices go, demand goes down, prices go down commensurately, and the yields go up. So both sides are working against, and that's why these yields are rising like this. The yields are sliding upward because we are, the supply of treasury, long-term treasury debt is going up, drives the price down, drives the yields up. Then we're also telling China, go to hell, we don't want to trade with you anymore. So the Chinese are saying, fine, you're a mama-san. And so that means that the demand for our debt is sliding downward. Demand goes down, prices go down, yields go up. Two separate factors working in the same direction. Yeah. Okay. Just point them out, just, and I'll take care of it at the end of the class. Just point them out to me. Thank you. Okay. Now. So there is your first lesson. Don't stomp on the world if the world can stomp back. Yes, the Chinese have huge amounts of money. They lend it to us because we can't control ourselves. And that's the same as with the Arabs. That's the same thing that's going on with the Japanese, with the Canadians. The Canadians even lend us money. And then we are going and we're kicking these people, whether they cheat or not. We're trying to fight the world right now. And that's a problem. As we do that, when I was down in Panama, it was fascinating to watch this incredible building that's going on, watching literally a second world country become a first world country, right in the middle of a bunch of countries that are nothing but miserable basket cases. Well, you know why that's happening? Where's that money coming from? Who is buying Panama's debt instruments that the Panama government is selling? The Chinese, the Arabs, and the Russians. They're more than happy to provide that money. But you know what's even worse than that? Any of you ever travel to Panama, live in Panama? They use American dollars. So if we don't want to have those American dollars flow there, China says, oh, we got American dollars. Panamanians say, we take American cash. And so all of that money's flowing there. And therefore, not just the capital, but also the political and economic influence of the world is shifting away from us because we don't want to be a player anymore. So all that building, the Chinese, the Russians, the Arabs, sure, we'll lend you the money. You take American dollars. We've got tons of American foreign reserves. America doesn't want our money anymore. They think we're bad people. So it's just flowing down to any country that takes American currency, one for one, and Panama does. And so who's going to open up and rebuild the Panama Canal and make it wider and bigger and deeper? The Chinese are. Who's going to make their banking system stronger with floods of dirty money? The Russians are. Who's going to use American petrodollars? to fund new highways and these stacks that are unbelievable that they're building of highway overpasses. The Arabs are. Who's going to make their airport one of the finest in the Western Hemisphere? Well, the Chinese, the Russians, and the Arabs are. Because we're no longer playas. Let that be a lesson to you. Don't fight if you don't have the even a hint of the advantage in the fight. Now, a mother's work is never done. Let's go on here. Let's go and talk about free cash flow. Let's talk about what a financial statement can do for us. Remember that financial statements on their own really don't help us because they talk about mostly the past, and they do things that are really, really kind of weird. Now, some things on a financial statement, one warning, and I've said this before and I'll say it again. Financial statements can mean the same thing, but they can have different names. The whole financial statement. You can have an income statement be called a consolidated statement of operations. You can have it be called a profit and loss statement. Within the financial statement, the same darn thing can have different words for it. Like operating income is the same as earnings before interest and taxes. A lot of companies don't even bother to put in some entries that we really kind of would like to have them put in. In fact, in your accounting classes, when they showed you these financial statements, looking at the income statement, I'll bet they broke out as a separate line depreciation. Do you remember whether they did or not? It was its own line on the income statement. Generally speaking, companies don't do that now. We have to go elsewhere to find that stupid depreciation. We need it. Now, the problem with depreciation is this. Depreciation actually doesn't exist as a real thing. However, it has a real impact. It has a real impact. Think about this. Okay. Now, sir, you know I run a ghost hunting club, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, ghosts aren't real, right? No, they're not. They don't exist. Except that when I see one, I tend to want to urinate. It doesn't exist, but you feel this weird, like a spider web float across your face, and you feel this chill, and you, or a demonic possession. Now, there's no demons in this world, but when you say someone say, Cthulhu is my god, and I eat dogs, you know that there's an effect from it. There was one we did over at Williams Hall, and whatever it was, it got us all creeped out enough that when a real noise got made, we left the building. I was sounding like Scooby-Doo, and these two kids in front of me were not moving fast enough. I just picked them up, and I took them in front of me. Fortunately, the doors opened fairly easily when I did that, but enough of that fun stuff. The thing, though, is that depreciation doesn't exist, but it has an actual impact. Because when I subtract depreciation from my revenues, it saves me money on taxes. Okay, so there is a tax shield that happens from that. But then I have to add the depreciation back later, but the shield actually still stays. Good example. What this means in cash flow terms is that companies have to consider after-tax consequences of decisions. Like, for example, this has been a few years back. Kellogg was curious. You know Kellogg, great company, long-standing, low beta, reliable company. They were interested in entering the market for gluten-free breakfast foods. Now, have you ever eaten gluten-free food? Madam, have you? There's one word that I can use to describe it. Blah! no joy, nothing in there that's worth my time. Okay? I mean, I have much better things to do with my stomach acids and my E. coli than have it process that kind of nonsense. However, it is an emerging growth market. Companies have been generally afraid. A lot of foods actually are gluten-free, but companies will not put gluten-free on it because it conveys that sense that this food was manufactured in this sucks land. Okay, so Kellogg once said, all right, we're going to put our muscle into this. Kellogg is tasty stuff. You ever had Kellogg cereal like, Frosted Flakes? They're great! And all that. So if you put the Kellogg label on it and say gluten-free, people might buy it. Even people who don't need to have gluten-free. We know for a fact that about 10% of the population in the United States claims that they are gluten allergic. We know that the actual number of gluten allergic people in the United States is less than 1%. So we've got a market there of people who imagine themselves to be gluten-free that's much larger than the market of people who actually need that. So Kellogg thought, okay, we're going to have to spend some severe money on producing a line of gluten-free breakfast pastries. They estimated that it was going to be about $10 million they'd have to spend. But if you think of that on an after-tax basis, if they expense that money or even depreciate it, that would mean that if they're in the 40% tax bracket, that's not $10 million they're spending. They're saving $4 million in taxes that they pay on all of their revenues. So the real after-tax cost of that project would have been $6 million, not $10 million. So the depreciation does the same thing. It's not real, but it creates a real tax shield. And so we have to keep that in mind. So that's why we need things like... Now, I'm going to do something here. Now, the company that I did in the first class, I like to do these without preparing to do them. Because then you see me screw up, and then you don't feel so bad. Well, you probably feel worse than I do because you flunk, and I just keep being a professor when I make a mistake. But other than that, I want you to see the actual thinking process behind what we do in this kind of work. And we have to... We don't care about net income. We call it earnings usually, and we don't really care about that. It, however, is where we start to make our free cash flow, which is what we really, really care about. Now, the one I did in the last class had a weird little twist in it. It's a great one, and I knew it was going to be interesting, but it did something that you don't expect. Usually, when you're working out free cash flow, there's this one place where you subtract out your capital expenditures. You add back the depreciation because that didn't really happen, but then you subtract out your capital expenditures because that's what really happened. I gave you the example of my own company. I spent $4,500 on new equipment. Well, that's $4,500 out of my pocket, so I have to subtract $4,500. But I'm not allowed to take all that away. I have to depreciate it over a period of years. If I straight line it, that would be $900 a year for 5 years. The $900 really didn't happen, so I have to add that back after I have considered its tax shield consequences. The real capital expenditure, I have to subtract off. The weird thing about Netflix, and I was just cruising along, yeah, this one's going to be really a great example, is that Netflix actually had last year negative capital expenditures. So in other words, I didn't subtract capital expenditures, I had to add capital expenditures. Now I'm thinking to myself, how in the hell does a company have negative capital expenditures? Well, they did spend money on property, plant and equipment, intellectual property, all that kind of stuff. So there was a negative capital expenditures there, but they sold something, a lot of something, so big that it swamped out their capital expenditures, and it wasn't a negative, it was a positive in the free cash flow. Let me explain. Look, free cash flow. Free cash flow. That is what we care about. Because when we value a company, we are going to value the net present value of future expected free cash flows, not the net present value of future expected net income. That's irrelevant. What we want to know, madam, you could have a lot of money for your net worth. But if you don't have the money to buy me Chick-fil-A sandwiches, well, go away. You're not my friend. Yeah, I know, it hurts, but Chick-fil-A is really good, and with those pickles, dang, that's good stuff. Seriously, the spicy, you know, gives me the wind, but anyway.
Try to stay on task, okay, please.
Here we go. Look, the thing is that we don't care if a company's profitable or not. We really don't. What we care about is whether or not that company is actually generating positive free cash flow at the end of the day. You can be all kinds of wealthy, all kinds of powerful, all kinds of this, that, and the other thing, but if you don't have the cash to pay the light bill, to pay the expenses, if you don't have the cash, then you're going to die, okay? You, sir, are a very healthy-looking man. Relatively, you know, a little work on the beard maybe, but
yeah, I gotta trim it up.
I know that neck beard is really kind of, you know, it's sort of Joe Black, but
it comes in kind of fast.
I know, right? You know, and it's kind of hard. You gotta carefully move it up there.
Yeah.
I use a ruler.
Really?
Yeah. Very, very sharp ruler.
I thought you were talking about the.
No, I do.
Oh.
Measure it and then make a line.
Okay.
Why do you keep getting me off track? Okay, look. I lost track of where the hell I was. Okay. You're a very strong, healthy person. What I don't know is that you actually are a vampire. You need blood every night, and you find out, well, man, I just don't have anything in me. I just don't like to bite people and take their blood. I mean, you know, these are my friends. So you're going to die. Okay. Blood is money, and money is blood, okay? And moving along, if you don't like my examples, well, bite me. Revenue minus costs. Now, minus depreciation, and I'm going to show you why this is a bit of a problem here. Because nowadays, most companies don't even put a separate line for depreciation. They just put it in their costs. And then you have to go and find it for fixing it later. So I'm putting that in there, but know that usually on the income statement these days, the depreciation is already there in the costs. And then minus the interest. Now this is what I'm showing you is the leveraged free cash flow. Unleveraged would say, well, the company doesn't owe any debt. Well, most companies do owe debt, so we're going to have an interest expense. Interest expense. Take these together, and we look at it after taxes. The TAU, T-A-U, is the marginal tax rate of the corporation. In other words, what tax it pays on its last dollar. Yeah, 1 minus T. This basically is, that line right there is on the accounting statement, net income. Now, let me show you something interesting here. And I swear, I thought this would be easy to do, but turned out. Leveraged free cash. Leverage is a fancy word for you've got debt in your capital structure. In other words, if this company didn't borrow money, it wouldn't have interest expense, so there wouldn't be an interest expense in there. This is basically net income, what I've written up there, subtracting all the expenses. Corporate tax rates. Now I'm hoping that I can see where I pulled it the last time. Tax tables. Is this the one? There they are. Here we go. Here is your, wait a minute. That was Denny's this morning, Grand Slam. Excuse me. Better. We have a progressive tax system. The higher the amount that the last dollar goes to, the higher the tax rate. Except that this is our new tax tables. There are two things that are a little bit weird in this table. Before I go to talking about the table and what it means for free cash flow, I want you to notice the table itself and the numbers in it. You see something interesting about our progressive corporate, these are corporate taxes. Is there anything you see in there? Talk to me. Oh my. And then it does it again. In other words, if you are a company that makes between $100,000 and $335,000, your tax rate would be 39%. But if you make just another little bit more, up to $10 million, your tax rate is only 34%. And then that happens again. A company that makes taxable income of $18,000 pays a 38% rate, but if you make $100 million, you pay only a 35% rate. There are two notches in the tax tables for corporations. Why is that? Well, if you ask the accountants and you ask the politicians, oh, it's because of all these complications in the tax system that we have to bring it down for those poor corporations that are between up to $10 million. No, it's because those companies between $1 and $10 million are major, major creators and funders of political action committees. And then those massive multinational global companies with taxable income in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, well, they are the ones who buy our politicians. We have the best government money can buy, Democrat or Republican. So our tax system creates a couple of candies for the givers. Now, I consider myself a giver. I give my cats cat food every night, but that's because they'd bite me if I didn't. But for our givers, we give them candy. Now, I want to point out something also interesting here about our tax system. And this is true of both the corporate and the personal, the household. Suppose that I borrow money, okay? Now, I have an interest expense of, in my company, $10,000, okay? Now, my little piss-ass company is in the 15% marginal tax bracket. Multinational corporation might be, let's say, in the 34% tax bracket. So my after-tax cost for me would be $10,000 times 1 minus 0.15. So my after-tax cost of debt is $8,500. Mega corporation in the 34% tax bracket has an after-tax cost of that very same amount of money of $6,600. I actually am punished for being a small corporation. That giant corporation, it is given much, much more benefit by using leverage, debt, than I am. This is true, by the way, with home households, too. The same rule applies. When you have a mortgage, you get to deduct your interest payments on your mortgage. If you are a wealthy family in a high tax bracket, let's say 35% tax bracket, your after-tax cost of debt is 1 minus 0.35, which is 65% of the original interest expense. But if you are a working poor, lower middle class family in the 15% marginal tax bracket, then your interest expense is 85% of the pre-tax. So the wealthy are rewarded more for having homes. As a matter of fact, for the wealthy, it is to their tax advantage not to own one but a couple of houses, so that they are deducting mortgage interest against full income, ordinary income. It has the impact, a much larger impact on saving them tax money than it does for a low-income family. So we, our tax system actually encourages the wealthy to have homes and much more than it encourages the poor people to have homes. That's just the reality of it. Keep that in mind the next time you decide that our tax system really is better the way it is. Although, unfortunately, if we didn't have a progressive system, it would be even worse for some other reasons. But anyway, okay, now, we got that. Now, we've got to do something else here. We've got to, first of all, okay, by taking out the depreciation, we are able to recognize that tax shield the depreciation created. But we know very well that the depreciation actually didn't exist, so we're going to have to add it back in. And then subtract out the real capital expenditures that actually happen. So in other words, in my company, I said I spent $4,500 on equipment, but I have to capitalize that over 5 years. That's $900 a year. I will take the $900 away here because I have to recognize that it actually saved me money on my taxes. I subtract it from my revenues. But then, realistically, I have to add that $900 a year back in here. God, it really didn't come out of anything. But then I have to subtract what I really spent, which was a whopping $4,500. I have to subtract that. That was real blood money that came out of my pocket. So I have to subtract out the capital expenditures. And that's what you're going to see with Netflix. The weird thing is that most companies have positive capital expenditures, which means a negative effect on free cash flow. Netflix somehow managed to actually have negative capital expenditures, which actually adds to free cash flow. I'm almost tempted to show you something other than Netflix just because of that one weird-ass thing, but there is something cool about Netflix at the end once we get the final calculation. And then there's finally one last thing. We have to subtract out changes in net working capital. Now, net working capital, NWC, is current assets minus current liabilities. Okay? So in other words, the change in net working capital is this year's net working capital minus last year's net working capital. In other words, think about it this way. Suppose my inventory goes up. That would be an increase this year in net working capital over last year. That's money out of my pocket. That's money out of my pocket. Think of this, receivables. This year was the first year that I was actually able to offer, in my own company, credit. You can buy now, pay later. And, of course, that really helped. There were people who see my art, and they say, oh, I love it, but I just can't afford that. Well, now I can say, well, I provide financing for your home, so it will look better. Great. I get sales, but the problem is the money doesn't come in right away. So my receivables go up, but that's actually draining on free cash flow. Because here's what's really nasty about it. At an art show this spring, I sold about $2,500 worth of art. Easily, I think $1,500 of it was on credit. People buying, buy now, pay later. I actually have to pay taxes on the $2,500, not on the $1,500. So the revenue went up $2,500, but I sure didn't see that. So I have to take that back out. The receivables went up. That's why I have to say, well, my change in net working capital was positive, which is a negative effect from the receivables, from the inventory, on my free cash flow. It hurt it. This is a nasty one. Here's an interesting one. Madam, you work for me. I love you to death. You're a great employee. I'm just not going to pay you this year. Now, you're going to be sad, but my accounts payable went up, my wages payable. I'm happy because that freed up cash flow. You know, it hurt you. Your kids are going to starve and all that kind of stuff. Your dog's going to leave you and they're going to throw you out on the street. But isn't it great that I am happy because I saved some cash? I increased my free cash flow by increasing my current liabilities. You see it? Same is true with a lot of things. Deferring is an art form in business right now. I mean, this is one of the ways that I'll give you a great example of this. I might have already told you this one. I was at a dinner a couple of months ago with some of the chief officers of a company, you know, executive level. And they were, one of them, the treasury officer, like a CFO. She's not the CFO, but she's up there in those ranks. She was kind of growling and laughing, too, about the fact that they got this very substantial payment in, cash in. And she was, it was like a couple of million dollars. And that's wonderful free cash flow. But then she almost had a heart attack when she found out that all of these people in accounting had started writing checks to pay bills. Oh, we heard the $2 million went in. We see it here on the ledger. Okay, let's start paying the bills. She said, are you out of your minds? These bills aren't due yet. This one isn't due for a month. These other ones are due in 6 weeks. We got bills that are due in 2 weeks. You're crazy to pay those now. We put the $2 million in the bank. We sweep it if we have to. We make money off it. We do not give that money until we have to. That is cash management strategy. That's how you do it. You're not going to pay your bills. I don't pay my bills until, you know, they send these, like, enforcers from Chicago. And then it's kind of too late because they hurt me. It hurt my feelings and all of that. But the bottom line is that this is the whole idea. You lower your receivables to the extent that you can, and you increase your payables to the extent that you can. That's cash flow management. You do that well, and your company is a lot healthier than it would be otherwise. Well, I always pay my bills as soon as I get them in the mail. No, look at the due date. And then think about, you know, add 3 or 4 days to that for them to get around to yelling at you. That's a little bit improper to say that, but that's the reality of it. That's how you control. There are a lot of ways you control free cash flow. But in the short run, it's an art form. Go.
Wouldn't that be terrible for your credit?
No. I mean,
4 days off?
Well, for me it is, but if you're Microsoft and you don't pay the bill for a couple of days.
Yeah, you're fine.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a story. It doesn't sound like it has anything to do with this, but it has everything to do with this. The famous painter Pablo Picasso, in his later life, he didn't do a lot of actual painting in his last years. But what happened was that when people would come to his door who he owed money to, or they'd send him letters, he owed them money. He would never, ever pay in cash. He would write a check because he would know that the check would never be cashed. Why not? Why did he know that if he paid, wrote these people he owed money to, he'd write them a check, he would never have to worry about that check being cashed? Anyone know why? His signature on the check was worth more than that check could possibly be worth otherwise. His signature, checks with his signature on them go for tens of thousands of dollars. Oh, a check for $20, you know, that was real cash flow management. You know, he wasn't just an artist, he was a financial genius, as it turned out. Although, as far as I'm concerned, his art was really weird ass. Where did he get models that had an eye over here and a part over here? He had to go to some serious accident wards to get... Anyway, okay, now. Now for the numbers. Okay. Let's go to sec.gov. And we are going to get company filings. We're going to do Netflix. NFLX. Go down here. Let's find its latest 10K. Financial statements. Consolidated statement of operations. Well, that's a fancy way of saying your stupid income statement. Profit and loss statement. Okay, let's look at it. Now, as I said, revenue minus cost minus depreciation minus interest expense times 1 minus your taxes. Well, hell, that takes you to the net income line. Look, your revenue minus your costs, minus your interest expense, minus your taxes, well, that takes you to your net income. Thank you, accountants. You saved me some pain here. Let me make sure you see that. Do you see it? I mean, that first line is nothing but your after-tax income. The accountants did that for us, and we thank them. We saved them, we saved ourselves, they saved us that first pain in the butt. See? Your costs minus your interest expense. Notice, what don't you see in here? Yep. Most companies just fold it into one of these lines. They don't even show it as a separate line anymore. And again, I don't know how they're doing it in your accounting classes, whether they show you income statements with the minus depreciation as a separate line or not. I just don't know. They do? Yeah. In the real world, they're not even showing it. We're going to have to actually go to the statement of cash flows to find that stupid line. Okay? But we're okay for right now. We've got the first line all done for us. What is that? 558,929. 558,929,000. 558,929. Got it. Now the next thing is that we have to add back the depreciation because it really didn't exist. This number includes the shield. The depreciation gave us. See, that depreciation and all of the other costs and the interest expense actually protects some of our revenue from taxation. So we recognized, yes, it had a real effect, the depreciation did. But now, because depreciation actually isn't a cash flow in and of itself, we're going to have to add back the depreciation. And like I said, back in the days, I mean, when I was doing this 10 years ago, it would be right there and I could put it in. But now, I have to chase down here to the statement of cash flows. And, wow. We've got some amortizations in there too. Crap. Okay. I'm going to have to pull up the calculator now. Okay, amortizations are just depreciations of things that don't exist, I like to say. Intellectual property. How did that happen? Okay. Okay, we've got, let me bring up that calculator again. You got to put in the amortizations too. Like, for example, I depreciate my physical equipment, my cameras, my computers, and all that. But there, I just paid the fees to trademark the name of my company. I have to depreciate it, but they don't call it depreciation, that expense. They call it amortization because it's an intellectual thing. It's not a physical thing. So, excuse me. Wow, that Grand Slam breakfast. Much better. Okay, now. Sean, okay. Amortization, we've got 619,787. Do you see how amortization is a huge thing for a company like Netflix? Because these are non-physical things we're talking about. We're talking about movies and stuff like that. Copyrights. And then plus, what else do we have? DVD content, 60657. 60657. Plus, what else do we have? Depreciation, 71911. 71911. Oops, I screwed that up. 71911. Did I do something wrong?
71, you just got hit the 9.
No, there's something else wrong there.
Second.
Yeah, that's second one. Got it. 6197817. See, it's actually, if you're doing this on a computer, it's better to use your number keypad. The problem, which I would be doing in another building, but they don't believe me when I tell them this number keypad. This keypad. Wait, is that a new one? Maybe it is. Okay, so let's try plus. I'm going to try the keypad. See what happens. 60657 6. Yep, it's not working. Let's try numlock. 60657. Oh, it's working now. Good. Okay, plus 71911. 71911. And that's all of them.
There you go.
Oh, knock it off. Don't trifle with me. I've had enough today. 6330385. 6330385. You see how that really is benefiting free cash flow here? I mean, they whacked so much off in depreciation and amortization. Now the next one, capital expenditures. This is the sources and uses statement. This is the statement of cash flow. Go down here, and this is the one that's the weird one. Come down here, investment activities. See how they do have capital expenditures. See those? I would love it if we stopped right here because we'd have a nice fat negative number of about $300 million. But they sold something. So in other words, the cash outflow from capital expenditures got swamped by this cash inflow from capital expenditures coming back from selling something. So at the end, they actually had a positive net cash flow from investments. So instead of subtracting, this would actually be, if this is a negative, you just say minus. But in this case, it's a positive, so you minus it again, and three four three two nine. See if that's a negative number. See if you've spent money, net spending money on capital expenditures. It's a minus. But in this case, they actually had, after they had spent money and then brought money back in from their activities, it turns out that that adds. Now, net working capital. Here's how that one's going to work here. We go back to the balance sheet. Let's come in here on the balance sheet. If I can find the stupid, but there's the balance sheet. Okay. Current assets minus current liabilities. In the current year, your current assets were 769 minus your current liabilities this year, minus the current liabilities, 5466 5466 312. So the net working capital for 2017 NWC for this current year, 2203 662. Now let's look at what it was last year. And I'm going to save this number. Current assets for last year were 5720 5720 291 minus current liabilities 4586 6567. So last year, their net working capital was 1133,634. Look at that. Their net working capital skyrocketed by over $1 billion. That is negative cash flow. Watch. Okay, make that one a positive neg plus the one I saved. Holy cow. $1,070,028,000. Howdy do. In other words, from last year to this year, their net working capital expanded massively, which is a drain on free cash flow. Now, really quick, I'll put that down. Minus $1,070,028,000. Before I actually calculate free cash flow for this year, how did the net working capital skyrocket? Do you see anything that actually was the principal culprit that made Netflix's net working capital go up so much? Yeah. No, no, this has got to be short term. Look, their cash they put under the mattress went up by $1.5 billion. That is actually a drain on free cash flow. And how did they get that? They borrowed all of, look at all this money they borrowed. Oh my God, they borrowed all that money, $3 billion, and $1.5 billion of it went under the mattress. So now we can actually do the final calculation. We're going to do 558,929 plus 633,0385 minus minus, which is plus 34,329 minus 1,070,028,000. There's a free cash flow. A miserable little number. Do you see it? That is the territory of tiny little companies. This company isn't, this company, look at its profit. Oh man, we're really doing well. Look at this net income. But from our perspective, this company is barely alive. That's why this company is such a damn risky company. Its free cash flow sucks. And that's what in finance we measure a company by. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.